Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, today's date is March 15th, 2011. Members, today we're going to be dealing with budget presentations from both the Supreme Court, Appeals Court, and District Courts, as well as the Department of Human Rights. The first presentation will be done by the courts, and Sue DeSalle, our State Court Administrator, and Judge Dave Knutson from the First Judicial District is here for the presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, my name is Sue DeSalle. I'm the State Court Administrator. And as you heard, with me is Judge David Knutson from the First Judicial District, and also with us are Chief Judge Matt Johnson from the Court of Appeals and Chief Judge Jim Swenson from the Fourth District. And with your permission, Mr. Chairman, what we thought we would do in this presentation, I would provide a brief summary of the judicial branch budget situation and our FY 12-13 request. Judge Knutson is going to respond to your request for the impact of not funding our unavoidable personnel costs. And then we thought we would ask Judges Swenson and Johnson to join us at the table for any questions that you might have.
All right. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to be working off the PowerPoint that is in your packet. And if you would turn to slide two.
Ms. DeSalle, could you pull the microphone closer to you? We're having a little trouble picking you up.
Very good. Thank you. So turning to slide two, as you know, the judicial branch carries a tremendous workload, and we are here asking for your support, not for the judges and lawyers, but really for the people that the court serves. The abused child in need of protection, the tenant seeking the return of a security deposit, the business owner needing to enforce a contract, and the state trying to hold accountable offenders in pursuit of the safety and security of our communities across the state. Now, we do not control our workload, as you know. We have to take each and every case that comes in the door, and the Constitution provides that we must handle each of those cases promptly and without delay. Now, turning to slide three, the Minnesota justice system is at the breaking point. As you have heard in our earlier testimony in this room, and as when the Chief Justice and I have visited with each of you in your offices, this is a system that is stressed from top to bottom, and as a result, delays and backlog are occurring in a commonplace across the state. One in four of our serious felony cases is taking longer than a year. In Olmsted County, they're setting felony trials out to June of 2012. 30% of our abused children who are taken out of the home take longer than a year for them to have a chance at a permanent placement. In many counties, it's taking as much as a month just to open up a civil and family case. In Winona, it's taking 6 weeks to enter a default judgment. So the delays have doubled, and in some counties even tripled in just the last couple of years. And as we testified in January, in the last 2 years, the Court of Appeals has had to dismiss the felony convictions in three cases, which, of course, is the ultimate constitutional safety valve for delays in the criminal justice system. So the bottom line, Mr. Chairman and members, is that this is a system that is already under tremendous stress to try to deal with some of the most important things in people's lives, their liberty, their property, their families, and their business interests. Well, turning to slide four, these delays are occurring because the judicial branch has been underfunded for a number of years, with base cuts in each of the last 3 years. In just this current biennium, we've had to close a $17 million gap, and last year the legislature authorized another 1% cut or $646,000 to the Supreme Court budget. On slide five, as a result of this, since FY08, we've lost nearly 290 positions in the branch. We're operating more than 10% short. We've reduced or shed those positions by implementing a voluntary separation incentive program, voluntary leave without pay, a hiring freeze, layoffs, and we've introduced and implemented a total pay freeze for all of our judges and employees this last 2 years. Now, on slide six, despite needing 20 more judges than we have to do the work that we have, in order to just help close this budget gap, the $17 million budget gap, we're now having to hold open every single judicial vacancy that occurs for at least 4 months. And we've also had to take cuts to retired judge use, which, of course, has only further exacerbated the judge shortage problem that we have. We've cut drug courts, we've cut mandated services and operating budgets, and we've had to close our public counters half a day a week in over half of our districts so that the reduced staff that we have a chance to kind of catch up with the paper processing, the computer data entry, and the filing responsibilities for that backlog of cases that's just stacking up. So moving now to slide seven, as we testified in January, for the next biennium, we are asking for essentially a hold harmless budget. The only funding, new funding that we're asking for beyond our current base is to cover unavoidable personnel costs. This is the increased costs for health insurance for employees as projected by MMB and the statutory increase, the mandated statutory increase in the employer contribution to employee pensions. The total of that for the branch is for the next biennium it would be $6,750,000. Now, we don't control any of those costs. We're just going to have to pay them. And if we don't get funding for these unavoidable costs, it's just going to mean more employees that we're going to have to lay off. On slide eight, what this means for us, with personnel costs accounting for over 85% of our budget, and we've cut everywhere to deal with this $17 million gap in this biennium, it means laying off about 60 more positions in the judicial branch. This is on top of the 287 we've already lost. So what this would mean is that we would be down nearly 350 staff in the branch, or about 12.5%. So, Mr. Chair, we move to slide nine. I'm now going to call on Judge Dave Knutson to talk a little bit about what this is going to mean if we don't receive funding for these unavoidable costs.
Welcome, Judge.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. Thanks for letting me come back and address you regarding this specific issue.
Could you identify yourself for the record again?
I'm Judge David Knutson, representing Dakota County in the 1st Judicial District. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Slide 9 is it just shows how this is a system stressed from top to bottom. We're doing everything we can to re-engineer, to bring in technology, and to cut our costs. We've done that for many years. We've done more with less, we believe, because of the technological and efficiency innovations that we brought to the judicial branch and served as a national model for. But the past budget shortfalls and reductions have cut into the muscle and now into the bone of the judicial branch. We're at the point where we have no choice but to do less with less. The Judicial Council, the governing body for the judicial branch, has identified 51 case types we handle, and we've established high, medium, and low case processing priorities as a guide should further budget cuts be imposed. And I just don't want to bring this to your attention. This is our case type priorities that we've produced. We've spent a significant amount of time on this over the last several years in the Judicial Council looking at how much time the cases take and what cases we should prioritize based on the statute and Constitution. And the ones that are highlighted in blue are the ones that we're going to have to delay and hold up on and simply won't be able to handle them in the normal course of business due to further budget cuts. We project we'd be able to unable to process over 344,000 low-priority cases because we simply wouldn't have the staff to process them during the biennium. Cases like shoplifting, trespass, worthless check, underage drinking, conciliation, court matters, consumer credit, property, and small property-related claims would stack up. And the same is true for thousands of traffic and ordinance violations. These cases are considered low priority only in relation to the other even more serious types of cases that we have to handle. And so the litigants are waiting for default judgments, tenants are trying to get back their security deposits, or landlords are trying to get access to the property. Businesses are seeking to deter shoplifting and the passing of worthless checks, and law enforcement's trying to enforce our traffic ordinance and misdemeanor cases. All of these cases are important to many, many people, but they do fall into our lower case priority list that we've had to establish in order to maintain the timing that we need for the more serious cases that we're required to handle. I'd ask that you flip to slide 10. When we look at slide 10, we're looking at the collateral effects on local state government. I know that you've all heard from your local and your local government units and their concerns about local government aid. But if we're unable to process a significant number of these low-priority cases, these traffic cases and whatnot, it's going to reduce the revenue that's now flowing to the state and local units of government. Each year, the judicial branch collects nearly $200 million in fines and fees that goes directly back into the state general fund or to the counties or the municipalities involved with those specific tickets. And this is this amount of money is primarily comes through the processing of these low priority cases. Counties and cities use this funding, as you know, to offset local public safety costs, and delays in processing these cases mean much less revenue to the state, city, and county coffers. Now, we've been here time and time again, and you've been reading about it in the paper about delays, and I just want to give you an example from some other cases that I just had this last week about delays. And what does that mean? Because when you just talk about delays, it's not that big a deal. We're all delayed at different times in life for different reasons, and things sometimes slow down. But let me give you the example of the case that I had last week. We had a jury trial, and we were ready to go. We swore in the jury, we were ready to proceed. The state was going to call their first witness. Now, this incident occurred in September of 2009. So this is a first-degree burglary charge that a young man has been having this charge hang over his head for over a year and a half. There were some discussions with the police officer, by the prosecutor. We had to send the jury home, and by that afternoon, with further discovery and further information that was obtained, the prosecutor decided to dismiss the case. This is a young man that was probably trying to find a job, probably trying to rent an apartment, and it took over a year and a half to get to trial where the charges were dismissed. Now, we talk about the threat to public safety when we can't get felons and offenders to court fast enough in order to punish them. But what about the flip side, the side where people may be innocent and the charges may not have been appropriate? We had somebody hanging that way for over a year and a half. And try to bring that case to trial. Do you remember where you were a year and a half ago, who you talked to, what was said? And are you going to testify and swear to tell the truth of exactly what happened and recount that incident over a year and a half ago? That's the reality that we're dealing with. Sue mentioned delays in child placements, collecting money, and holding offenders accountable. We are trying our utmost to avoid delays. And so it's not just a word we're throwing around here. So what do we do to avoid the delays? As a judge, I talk faster. I can swear somebody in where they don't even understand what I just said. That's not a good thing. That's not a good thing at all. Representative John Creasel came and did a ride-along with me 2 weeks ago. He spent the morning with me, and he commented how incredibly fast all these files were going through and how the cases were handled and how the files just kept coming and coming and coming and how quickly we'd open up the file, deal with it, shut the file, hand it over to the clerk, slide the people over, and call the next case. So that morning I was able to handle 49 cases with him sitting there, and we were arraigning people, making sure they understood their rights, making sure they understood the charges against them. We were sentencing some of the people who wanted to just resolve their case, and we were reviewing conditions of release. So we can talk faster. The other thing we can do is we can add more people to the calendar, add more files to the calendar, and that's what we've been trying to do in the First Judicial District. Let's just increase the size of the calendars, because these delays are really a concern for the court system, because you've heard time and time again, and you've known since grade school social studies, that justice delayed is justice denied. But the results to the calendar are that we then extend the afternoon calendar to 5:30, 6:30, and that doesn't work for the employees whose day ends at 4:30. And because we don't have any money, we don't pay overtime, but they have to stay there. So we have to make it up to the employees. So we have to give them compensation time. And we have to do it within that pay period. So now we already don't have enough court attendants and court clerks. And now what we're doing, because we're trying to avoid the delays, we're taking them out of the morning calendar for tomorrow. So they stay home for a couple hours to pick up their comp time. And then we don't have people and clerks to prepare the calendars and to sit with us and handle all the files and to record everything that's happening in court the following morning. So what we've done is we've in order to be efficient, effective, increased the use of technology, we've pulled the clerks out of the offices, put them into the courtroom, handling all the office work in the courtroom and the dealing with all the defendants and all the parties and the litigants. And now there's nobody in the office, very few people in the office, to answer the phones and to meet the people that are coming into the courthouse because they couldn't get through on the phone, so they thought they'd come in person, but there's nobody there, and they're standing in line to deal with a very personal, very important matter. The last thing, what else happens with these delays as we're trying to rush things through? Unfortunately and regretfully, there's mistakes. And you know in your own lives when you try to rush something through, there's mistakes, and sometimes we try at our utmost to avoid them. But we try to compact as many appearances by one defendant into one appearance so they don't have to keep coming back, so they don't forget, no warrants don't get out, we don't have to pull files, we don't have to add their name to a calendar again, so we consolidate their cases. So we have three or four cases that they're going to appear on. So we think we have it all worked out, and we deal with the serious felony case and all the misdemeanor tag-alongs and the probation violations and handle all of that, but guess what? We missed one file. We missed one file, and a warrant went out another day because nothing happened on the file, so somebody assumed that they didn't appear, and the young man was picked up. Well, I was able to deal with it immediately just because I said, well, quick, put it on my calendar and we'll take care of it and sort it out. So we had to gather up all the files and figure out, well, what exactly happened? Is he telling the truth? Did he really deal with it at that last appearance? Were they all wrapped together, and this was just one that didn't get handled and didn't get inputted because of the speed with which we were moving along? And that's exactly what happened. His mother was there, and she was so thankful we were able to deal with it. He only spent one day in jail that he didn't have to. But they were off to grandfather's funeral. And he almost missed the funeral because of the warrant. So these are just small examples that are happening every single day in the courthouses that in the areas that all of you represent of what a delay is. That's the definition of delay. I want you to turn to slide 11, if you would. This is our final slide. And I would just take you to the courthouse here, and this is where the people come to deal with things that are most important to them, most personal to them, their family, their freedom, and their property. And we've said this time and time again that the courts aren't for the judges, the courts aren't for the lawyers. The courts exist for the people. The courts exist for the litigants there. We hope that we will not need to implement these case priority delays and further diminish aspects of our justice system that citizens of Minnesota rely on. We ask you for your help. We appreciate what this committee has done for us already. But we ask that this committee and the entire legislature recognize the judicial branch as a separate and co-equal branch, and that this is one of the top priorities for government and for the state of Minnesota, because justice is not an option, it's an obligation. Thank you, members, and Mr. Chairman. At this time, we would be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have about the judicial branch and the effect of future cuts. But also, we also have joining us Judge Jim Swenson from the District Court, and Judge Matt Johnson from the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Judge Knutson. Are there any questions for the judges? Yes, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for you, and then a comment regarding the presentation with regard to the cost, the impact of the cuts of $200 million that was cited. Is that going to be factored into the fiscal analysis as we make our budget determinations here in this committee?
The Senator Latz, the last cuts over the recent years, 211. We are looking at recognizing the request that the courts have given us for this year only.
Then, Mr. Chairman, will that recognition of the request for this year also factor in the impact of reduced revenue from the work that will not be done by the courts?
Perhaps Ms. Dosell might be able to answer that question better than I at this time. Ms. Dosell.
Mr. Chair, and Central Labs, we haven't costed out what that likely loss in revenue would be to state and local. We could make an attempt at that if you would ask us to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd make that request. I think it'll be valuable information as we make our budget decisions here. and then just in the way of a comment, some of the list of the low priority cases that won't be processed for lack of resources. You know, we've heard testimony before about the impact of delay and resulting in some cases being simply dismissed on constitutional grounds. But some of these, they simply won't be able to initiate if it's clear that there's going to be delay or they won't be processed. Some of the traffic violations, I suspect the word will have to go out, you don't write the ticket because they're never going to get heard. When they get into court, and that'll be a constitutional violation. Some of those that have civil collateral consequences, like no insurance citations, where often notice is given to the Department of Public Safety and a driver's license is suspended administratively. unless and until someone comes in with notice. A lot of times people have insurance, but they don't come with proof of it within the 10 days that's required. They get suspended. They come in when they have court on the criminal case, and then the prosecutor simply dismisses the citation altogether. But if they never get to court on the criminal case, that's going to sit on the record. It'll cause an increase in their insurance rates and other and longer license revocations and probably more violations as people are driving without valid licenses to get to work and so on. With regard to implied consent revocations, that's got a separate constitutional basis, and under current Supreme Court law, if they're not heard within 60 days, both under the statute but also constitutionally, their due process is violated, depending on some wrinkles on how the criminal DWI case is handled. But you might be in a position where they won't be able to initiate the implied consent process or issue an implied consent notice of revocation because the courts will never be able to handle those cases within a constitutional time frame. That would have a serious impact on public safety. So, I mean, there's some of the – you probably come up with incidences for all the other items on the list, but I thought I'd highlight those for the committee's consideration.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And who can answer the question, but, I mean, as we've gone through this, and maybe Judge Knutson's good to see you. When I think through some of these issues on the lower level, we've talked about, you know, changing our structure, our statute, some of our legal structure in order to handle a lot more of this lower-level offense, as you call it, administratively. So when you talk about doing things in a timely fashion, is there any advice you might give as to, you know, can we legally change things to handle things administratively you know, how can we take that load off or some ideas on what we would need to do to change that to handle these things more efficiently and not tie up the courts as much, I guess, as the bottom line.
Judge Knutson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, what the courts have done in cooperation with the legislature in the past is to designate certain low-level offenses as payables. And at times it's become a little controversial, and it's controversial among the courts. There's judges that feel very strongly about certain offenses in their communities, and certainly those communities feel strongly about certain offenses like minor consumption, and that they ought to appear in court, and they ought to have a hearing, and they ought to be accountable to a judge. But that's where the rubber hits the road. Can we continue to deal with those cases when we simply don't have the staff to process them? And I might add that a lot of these are some of them that we've suggested that legislatures come back and say, well, we don't want to go that far, and those should not be payables because we want accountability. We want people to appear before a judge.
Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Judge Knutson. And I'm just going to use kind of an example of I got a traffic ticket a while back, and I don't believe I was in violation of anything. But
sure.
But when I appeared,
sure.
When
yeah.
I
never
appeared,
heard that before.
Yes. When I appeared to this certain
order.
Yeah.
Always wanted to do that with judges in the room.
You had to appear at this certain city to tell them whether you wanted to, you know, move it on to court or not. An initial hearing officer, I think I had to meet with or something, and they offer you this great deal. Well, if you just pay it today, it won't go on your record if you don't have another violation within a year. And though I really wanted to fight the fight, if you will, you know, you start looking at, and I think in this case it was like $100 or something, and you just go, well, I don't really want to pay $100. I didn't do anything wrong. I was really ticked off. But you start looking at the same kind of thing as a business person, yeah. As a normal person, is do I take the time out of my day to go to court over something so small just to prove my case, or do I pay the $100 and I know I'm not going to get another ticket the next year? It's no big deal to me. But that's an administratively handled thing. And so I see how you're missing the court process if you want to make the fight, but on the other hand, you know, people do make mistakes, and on some of those things, I think by having that time period of that year and not getting anything else on your record, you know, perhaps that's what certain people need in minor infractions and to handle it administratively. What do you think about situations like that.
Well, we
Judge Knudsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Jungbauer, we're open at looking at all of that, but, you know, is the legislature willing to make more of these things payables to allow us to handle that, more of them on an administrative-type basis?
Senator Jungbauer.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, and I don't know who else would be willing to work on that, but I would be willing to work on that. I know there needs to kind of be some level of disconnect between the courts. You operate under a different branch of government, and you, I've been told, you can't tell us what we should be doing, which is, which I understand that, but to get any kind of help, so if you could direct us, Judge Knudsen, or anyone that would help us through that process of how to go about making some of those more payables and working on a process that might get people thinking about their infractions, because I've tried to work with a few people from the courts, and they've said, well, we can't tell you what to do. We can just kind of give you a little vision or something, and that wasn't really that helpful. So perhaps you can, behind the scenes, send somebody my way. And if anybody else is on this committee is interested in working on those kind of things, I'd love to get there.
Thank you, Senator Jungbauer. Judge Knudsen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, we certainly can work with you on those issues. And I know that Senator Ortman has been very vocal about asking that the judicial branch be a little more aggressive in pursuing things, and we have. We brought legislation forward, items that have been well vetted in the judicial branch, and we're trying to pursue those changes to statute. And they're difficult at times because they're not easy things. And so, but it's the kind of Hobbesian choice. If we're not going to get more money or we're going to get cut, then something has to give, and the changes are not easy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Latz.
Thank you. I brought this up in the past, and I'll just throw it out there, even though it's not an easy question to deal with. But what about the distribution of resources between judicial districts? I know Hennepin County is amazingly efficient. That's the one I appear in the most often. But I've been in other courts around the state where, frankly, they're handling cases in the courtroom on the record that would never see the inside of a courtroom in Hennepin County, and it's taking up judicial time in some of the greater Minnesota counties where it would never take up that kind of time in Hennepin County or some of the other counties in the metro area. Has there been discussion within the judicial branch of redirecting resources to the counties that have the highest caseload to ameliorate some of the impacts that you're describing?
Senator Latz,
the Judicial Council is the governing administrative body for the judicial branch and determines the allocation resources among the judicial districts. We have used a objective formula for calculating that is basically based on workload. Several years ago, we had, as part of our formula, in a aspect of it that would recognize that metro higher volume courts had certain economies of scale, and that rural counties, just to keep the doors open, sometimes you'd have to have a certain level of staff, you know, two and a half positions just to keep the doors open. When we started to receive base cuts from the legislature and regularly we're not having shortfalls, we revisited that through the Judicial Council, and that type of a subsidy for the lower volume courts was eliminated. And so the distribution now for within the judicial branch is based on an even uniform, consistent formula across the state that is basically based on workload.
Any other questions? I have a few questions. If I could turn you back to the slide 6 on your presentation, impact of past budget cuts and shortfalls, you made mention of holding open judge vacancies for 4 months. What would that do to caseloads and of course, time delays again? Doesn't that further compound the time delay by having a vacancy for a judgeship and then not, due to that attrition, then following or waiting a few months for it?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. We have between 12 and sometimes as many as 15 judgeships that are open. You can imagine the FTE that's lost. As we said, we need 20 more judges than we have right now. And now we're holding open all of these vacancies, so it's like losing another three judges. Plus, we have had to cut our retired judge use on top of that. So we're you know, really hurting in the area of judge complement. And these budget cuts have taken their toll. But in terms of the Judicial Council, they certainly have felt that we need to, across the board, staff as well as judicial unit staff and judges, have to take some of the brunt of these budget cuts in an appropriate way. And we felt that this was the most appropriate way to have to deal with part of the $17 million budget gap that we've been trying to close this last biennium.
Mr. O'Sell, I also noticed on the same slide it was mentioned the cutting of drug court funding. Drug court is a specialized court. It specializes in this genre of court procedure. How does that affect the rest of the judiciary when a specialized court is cut in funding? How does that affect the system itself?
Yeah, I'm
Judge Swenson?
Yeah.
Could you identify
James
yourself
Swenson
for the record?
From Hennepin
please?
County. I'm the chief judge in the fourth. One of the remarkable success stories of all of these problem-solving courts, the drug court, the DWI court, mental health court, our new veterans court, is that it reduces recidivism drastically. So when those problem-solving courts get cut, then that reduction in recidivism component is gone. So we'll see more of those people come back that we were able to move out of the system through the problem-solving courts. So it's the end game is not very rosy when we have to stop those unique courts that deal with recidivism, those people that we might call the frequent flyers that come into court all the time, the mental health court, for example, where all the people in our mental health court have to go to our PRISM Center to have their medications administered by Hennepin County. The idea is that we can keep these people on their medications and they don't commit the quality of life crimes. We close down the mental health court, then we've got the people back on the corner doing the solicitation and public prostitution and all the things that drive the communities nutty. And the problem-solving courts are the best way we found to deal with this. The national trend in all court change and opportunities is evidence-based practices. For a long time, we just people came in, we adjudicated them, and we sent them away or we imposed a fine without any indication whether that was effective in remedying the situation. All of these problem-solving courts are based on evidence-based practices which tell us the right way to do things so that we decrease recidivism and save a lot of money for taxpayers in the long run.
Judge, I'm glad you brought that up. I know that I had an earlier discussion with Senator Jungbauer regarding recidivism rates. Yeah. And how if we have any type of program that would limit recidivism to a greater degree, that should be programs that we should be paying unique interest in when we apply budgets. And I never thought of a recidivism rate being applied to the process of justice. I always consider that as a process of the corrections department. And so it's important for us to know that interplay. Could you expand on that? Why is recidivism rates lower in a specialized court?
Well, because they get specialized treatment. For example, when somebody has a chemical or alcohol-driven criminal propensity, historically, the court has maybe ordered some treatment, but it was kind of a one-size-fits-all. In the Veterans Court, for example, instead of just having somebody undergo some regular treatment, what we do is we put them in touch with the vets, vet hospital, and they get them treatment, which is uniquely situated to deal with post-traumatic stress syndrome, traumatic brain injury, and the other drivers of criminal conduct from our vets coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's the key to treating them. We still have Vietnam vets on the street that have been in court time and time again because they never got help when they returned from Vietnam. The whole idea of the Veterans Court is not to replicate that and visit it upon my colleagues to be in the future, 20, 30 years from now, lots of veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq that never got treatment that was specifically geared to help them come back into society and be performing members of society rather than to default to the mental health and chemical issues.
Thank you. Yes, Ms. Dussel.
Just follow up on that. One of the key principles for these drug courts and chemical abuse courts is that there would be frequent and random drug testing as well. So you're using the coercive power of the court to get people that basically have a substance abuse problem but have not been able to be successful in any other venue. And they come into the drug court. They have ongoing, usually to begin with, a weekly appearances before the judge, random drug testing two or three times a week for the first number of months. You need this like 6 months to stabilize their life and for their brains to begin to function, actually. So there's this whole chemistry of the brain. And this drug court with the treatment providers, public defenders, prosecutors, the judge, they are all there in understanding what this problem is and helping the individual. There's work on getting them jobs, getting them GEDs, getting them housing, all of the things that are so often not available to them in terms of their recovery and ability to lead a sober and law-abiding life. And so it takes sometimes 18 months, maybe even 3 years, for an individual to graduate. They may have lapses, but the program keeps working with them until they're successful. And so I think that's part of it, is that it's not just treatment that they go off and you never hear about them again. It's really this ongoing interaction between the court and the individual.
Just one other point, if I may, when you talked about that recidivism impacting the courts, and not just corrections. It is a key component for the executive branch, from the prosecutors, the police. And the best evidence of that is all of these random drug tests that we have in our DWI court, for example. That's all on a volunteer basis from each of the municipalities. They believe so much in these courts that their officers do this for us. And one of the reasons is, when somebody has an alcohol or chemical problem and it keeps cropping up, it causes dysfunction in the neighborhood. And Bloomington was the first one to step up and say, we're going to give you police officers to do this, because they're so delighted in that once we get control of somebody and we get them sober and we get them on some positive course, then everything abates in the community and they don't have to go out and make tons of calls just to bring peace in the neighborhood. And there's a whole host of communities in Hennepin County that volunteer their police officers to do this. The State Patrol now does it, and the Hennepin Sheriff does it as well.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions? Sir Marty.
Mr. Chairman, not a question, but an observation that this is an area where a small decrease in funding or, and therefore the services and the problems multiply. I mean, it's kind of one thing falls through the crack, whether no public defender or somebody's case gets continued. And the problems multiply with it. So a small cut has a huge consequence, and we're at the stage now, it sounds like, where any little thing we do makes the problem a whole lot worse in five different areas and making the needs greater than.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Any other questions for the judges? Judge Johnson, you came all this way and you have nothing to say.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity, of course, to be here. The Court of Appeals is like the rest of the branch in that we have about 10% of our positions left vacant at the moment. For us, that impacts our unit of staff attorneys and law clerks, which are critical to the operation of an intermediate appellate court. We don't have the type of administrative positions that the other courts do. We don't have HR or finance or IT. We don't have people employed by our court who receive filings over the counter. We rely upon state court administration and the clerk of the appellate courts for that. So if we had to reduce our staff, the first person reduced would be an attorney, either a staff attorney or a law clerk, and so would the second and third and the fourth and the fifth and so on. And that would directly and immediately affect our decision-making capacity.
And just for the record, you're Judge Johnson from the appellate court.
I apologize. Yeah, Matt Johnson, Chief Judge of the Minnesota right. Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you again. Every time you come here, you give us a little more peeling back of the veneer of what you're facing. Thank you. Appreciate
thank
it.
You, Mr. Chairman, and members.
Next on the agenda is the Department of Human Rights. Commissioner Kevin Lindsay. Commissioner Lindsay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. I appreciate that.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
And sure. My name is Kevin Lindsay, and I am the current commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Mr. Chair and Senators, I appreciate the opportunity to address you today and provide you with information concerning the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. First, as this is the first time I've ever appeared before the committee and have had an opportunity to interact with any of you, I thought I would give you a little background on myself. My wife and I will celebrate 20 years of marriage later this month, and we've been fortunate enough to have been blessed with three children, three boys ages 16, 13, and 9. Prior to coming to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, I worked in the private sector or public sector with Ramsey County Attorney's Office, working on a variety of matters, including employment law issues, welfare benefits, real estate condemnation matters, election law, and civil rights. And actually, the day before I became commissioner, I was actually before the Minnesota Supreme Court on an issue concerning Government Data Practices Act. I've also represented clients as an attorney with two prominent law firms in the Twin Cities. In private practice, I worked as an attorney, primarily representing clients in the areas of employment law, product liability law, and business litigation, and I was a former colleague, actually, of Chief Judge Matt Johnson of the Court of Appeals. As an attorney in private practice, I've represented clients before the Minnesota Department of Human Rights and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and I've also provided assistance to the Minnesota Human Rights Department and St. Paul Human Rights Department training investigators for those entities. I've also been lucky enough to work as in-house counsel and chief operating counsel for a healthcare provider, which allowed me to manage outside counsel and assist in running a private business. I've also spent time volunteering in the community. For example, I have served on the board of the St. Paul Public Housing Authority, Senior Resources, YMC, Black Achievers Program, Walker West Music Academy, Association of Residential Resources. In addition, over the past 16 years, I've also had an opportunity to learn many life lessons coaching youth sports such as baseball, basketball, and soccer. I give you this background because I believe my professional experience and firsthand knowledge of the statute professionally working with nonprofits and working as a business leader gives me a very unique perspective. I don't believe I come to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights knowing all the answers, but I do believe I know the right questions to ask the staff and believe that I will bring the right temperament to be able to lead the Minnesota Department of Human Rights to be a very successful state agency. There are some of you who are new to the legislature, so let me give you a little bit of background on the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights was established in 1967 to enforce and administer the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which is codified under Minnesota Statute 363. This body enacted the Minnesota Human Rights because discrimination in employment, housing, public services, public accommodation, and education, quote, threatens the rights and privileges of the inhabitants of this state and menaces the institutions and foundations of this democracy, end quote. And that's specifically from the Human Rights Act published by this body. The core functions of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights are as follows. Investigate and make determinations on charges alleging discrimination. Assess compliance of voluntary settlement agreements and corrective action plans. Monitor state contractor compliance with applicable affirmative action provisions. Develop and disseminate technical assistance to persons subject to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Educate and eliminate unfair discriminatory practices. And develop and oversee statewide human rights policies and programs. As the new commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, I'm committed to ensuring that the agency continues to enforce and administer the Minnesota Human Rights Act and that all the employees understand the work toward achieving high performance and realizing the core functions of this agency. The specific agency itself, the enforcement unit, we received approximately 4,424 inquiries last year. We have 38 full-time equivalents. Again, we received just inquiries just on the enforcement of over 4,000. Last year, 855 charges were drafted by the department. The charges, 785 of those charges resulted in a recovery of almost $1 million in remedies. All of these remedies recovered by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights are deposited into the state's general fund. The contract compliance unit, responsible for reviewing affirmative action plans for businesses and issuing certificates of compliance. In 2010, the unit provided consulting services, again, to over 2,090 businesses, conducted state contractor showcases, and made 8,342 technical assistance contacts and conducted 68 compliance audits. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights charges businesses $75 for obtaining certificate of compliance. The $75 charge does not cover the administrative costs of the agency to run the certificate of compliance program. The Education and Program Development Unit conducted public forums, local business showcase training, produced a video of series that was broadcast in collaboration with public television, and conducted the department's annual human rights conference. Historically, none of the educational programs created by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights have been viewed as revenue-generating activities. Any fees charged by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights in the past were done so only to cover administrative costs of the respective educational program. Again, when we think about these respective numbers, again, it's important to keep in mind that we're only talking about 38 individuals being able to do all of this work. I would add that there's also answers which are not tracked by the agency as it relates to how small businesses can properly ensure compliance with the Minnesota Human Rights Act. As a new commissioner, I will bring that information to you at some later time because I think it's important for you to understand and appreciate the hard work of the employees of this agency and what they're doing as it relates to assisting small businesses to ensure compliance. The largest challenge facing the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is having sufficient staffing to be able to adequately enforce and administer the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The agency, similar to other law enforcement agencies, has experienced a reduction of staff due to cuts in funding. In January of this year, the agency reported that the average caseload per enforcement officer during the reporting year had increased to 37 cases per year. And on average, the time from the filing of a determination till the issuance of the decision is slightly over 400 days. Additionally, the January 2011 report noted that the agency likely faces an increase in the number of charges filed. And this is, if you take a look at the number of cases which were filed in the first half of 2010, you'll see a 30% increase in the number of cases filed during that six-month period. We've not calculated the numbers for this latter half of 2010, but we believe that that trend will increase, and 2011 will be no different. Accordingly, any reduction in the funding in the next biennium for the department will have an impact on staffing and consequently impact the ability to administer and enforce the Minnesota Human Rights Act. I say that for one other reason, and that is because 80 to 85% of the funding for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is employee wages and benefits. There's just not anything in which to cut except for employee staffing. The past biennium, there were a couple of things which the agency attempted to do in face of the budgetary challenges at that particular point in time. One was greater use of alternative dispute resolution. The agency has implemented a voluntary alternative dispute resolution program using pro bono or volunteer attorneys. The program offers the parties an opportunity early on in the process to resolve discrimination charges brought before the agency. Consistent with the rules of civil procedure codified in Rule 114 in the Minnesota General Rules of Practice, we were able to use these mediators in 128 cases which were brought before the agency were resolved. The agency has also made a great commitment to the use of technology, and we will continue to do so. The last 2 years, we've updated the workflow-based case management system, and as a result, storage filing costs have been reduced. More time is devoted to value-added activities instead of sorting, routing, and chasing down paper. Copying costs have also been greatly reduced. And as a practicing attorney, I can tell you that this system, there are a couple of firms that are probably more leading edge than this agency, but I would venture to say that you're really talking about only a handful of firms. And I could probably name the 10 or 15 that have probably a better system than what exists at the agency. Smaller firms, less than 50, probably do not have a case management system internally better than the one that's at the agency now. Having said that, yes, there are tweaks. There are things that we're going to need to do to take a look at that to further refine the process. But there has been an investment in technology, and it's been a valuable one for. Having said that, there's a need to continually update such a system once it is in place. And that is something that is going to be important for us. I was really struck by the comments by the respective judges, which were before you as it relates to how they handle cases and the impact on the respective court systems that they were addressing, specifically at the district court level and the court of appeals level. As a practicing attorney, I can tell you firsthand that all of those things are true and accurate and that I've seen firsthand. At the agency, we're having that same type of struggle discussion. How much time to give each respective matter which is brought before us? How do we streamline the process by ensuring that justice does prevail and that it's not lost in the process of just trying to get something out the door? I will work very diligently and very hard with my senior staff to ensure that we strike that right balance. But again, when we come back and we're talking about the number of full-time equivalents that are currently there at the agency, any cut will dramatically impact our ability to deliver on justice. You will notice in the handout that we provided for you on pages 7 and 8, and I'd like to direct your attention to some of the cases which we have identified there within the materials for you. I won't read through those for you, just to have those pointed out to you so that you can read them at your leisure. But I think that they're important for you to review because they demonstrate why the agency is important. In the conversation that we had with some of your colleagues from the House, there was this sense that the work which is done by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, it basically is the same as the work which is done by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. While there is some overlap between the respective two agencies, there is not complete overlap. The Equal Employment Opportunity is limited only to issues concerning employment. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights and the reach under the Minnesota Human Rights Act is much broader. There's also some sense that federal agencies and federal laws will reach down and they will be able to provide protection to Minnesota citizens. Generally, the federal law stops short of reaching down to smaller businesses. So, for example, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's 50 employees. So all employees under 50, the only guarantee that those citizens have as it relates would be under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. There are local human rights departments within the state of Minnesota, but there is not a human rights equivalent at each city and county. The only human rights organization which covers all citizens in the state of Minnesota is the Minnesota Human Rights Department. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate you giving me this time to be heard. I'm very respectful of the difficult decisions that you have to make. And I wish you well in trying to make those decisions. I'd like to try and provide as much information as I can for you. And I'm sure I'm not the first one to tell you that there are important things that we're doing and that we need to be able to continue to do those by having adequate funding and staffing to be able to do so. And with that, I would welcome any questions that you have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I'm looking at your handout on page 6, and right up the lower part of the top third, there was, you know, the myth and the reality. It says the Minnesota Human Rights Act provides more civil right protection to Minnesota citizens than federal law, and I think you kind of touched on that a little bit in your presentation, but could you enumerate for me some more examples of the difference between the federal law and the state law?
Sure.
Commissioner Lindsey.
Senator Newman and Mr. Chair, I'll give you an example, the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. The federal law provides for protection of individuals from the age 40 and older. The Minnesota Human Rights Act begins at the age of majority. There are other provisions as well as relates to public assistance, which we provide, which is different. So, yes, there are differences between the federal and the State Human Rights Act and applicable federal laws protecting civil rights.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, would it be fair then to say that, you know, in general terms, the Minnesota Human Rights Act is more restrictive than the federal law? Would that be fair?
Commissioner Lindsey.
Senator Newman and Mr. Chair, restriction I would ask, I guess, for clarification concerning that, because as this body enacted the Minnesota Human Rights Act, it said that these rights to education, non-discrimination, are important civil rights. So from the vantage of all citizens, there are important things in which to have. So government is protecting the rights of individuals under these respective laws. So there is no restriction if you view it as a civil right. It's something which is insured and guaranteed for every citizen.
Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm looking at your example, and one was here where there was a part of a conciliated settlement, an agreement to pay $13,000 to a former employee and develop a written policy regarding discrimination on the basis of sex and pregnancy. That's the second to the last paragraph on page 7, just so you can find it. And in terms of your agency, just a hypothetical question. Let's assume that the individual in this case filed a complaint with the agency, and the employer here was willing to settle with the department by adopting and accepting all of the written policies regarding discrimination that the agency wanted, but refused to pay the claimant, is suggesting that the claimant simply proceed on her own through the court system in order to collect whatever damages she may have felt is appropriate. Under those circumstances, would the department or would the agency accept the settlement and allow the complainant then to pursue her claim for damages through the court system, or would the agency refuse to settle?
Senator Newman and Mr. Chair, the role as it relates to the Department of Human Rights, we can't compel either the respondent or an individual to accept the terms of the settlement, as we are a neutral party, unless we are the one bringing the action. And then we would, from that vantage point, be able to say yes or no as to whether we would agree with the terms of settlement. As it relates to this instance, and let's play it out, at the beginning of an investigation, if the department felt that there were policies or procedures of the employer, because we're talking about employment here, which did not comply with the Minnesota Human Rights Act, there may be a dialogue and discussion with the employer to address and rectify that situation, the lack of the procedures or policies in place. As relates to the monetary relief, which happened in this case, there would probably be a determination made by the investigator concerning the impact of the discriminatory action by the employer as it relates to the individual. On the basis of that calculation, there would be a dialogue and discussion between the employer and the Minnesota Human Rights Department as it relates to what would be appropriate under the circumstances. Would it always require some type of monetary payment? No, it would not always require monetary payment. If the employer spoke with the department's investigator early on within the respective process, the response might be from the agency that there is no need for a monetary payment. If later on within the discussion or dragged out, there might be a situation. It may also be impacted by how the discriminatory practice impacted the individual employee.
One follow-up question, Mr.
Chairman. No, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your answer, Commissioner, but my question really is, under the hypothetical question that I'm asking you, would the agency take the position of refusing to accept the employer's settlement of developing and the written policies unless complainant was paid some money by the employer?
Commissioner Newman and Mr. Chair, I'd have to know more facts to be able to answer that question, yes or no. And here are the facts I would need to know. The impact as it relates to the employee. For example, we don't know within the information here, but I suspect that the length of time that the individual was denied being at work was close to the amount of $13,000, to the extent that the individual has only been off of work for 2 or 3 days because of the discriminatory decision made by the employer, monetary relief might be something which might not be part of it. And then before we would say no. If the individual action had resulted in the individual being off work for 3 or 4 months, creating financial hardship for the individual, then the department might take the position that part of the settlement needs to include some type of financial payment being made to the individual.
That's fine.
Sir Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindsay, on page 6, and in reality number 3, I've always had this question in my mind and never know quite how to use it. At the bottom of that paragraph, it says, age and gender charges are all so among the top 4. And when I go back to your chart on page 4, I don't see a gender on that chart. I'm assuming it refers to sex.
Correct.
Would that be true? Okay. So my question is, what is the difference between gender and sex, and when do you use one over another?
Commissioner?
Historic, Senator Hall and Mr. Chair, as relates to historically how the commission has done it, I can't say as I sit here right now. I'd have to get back to you specifically on that respective question.
Okay. I was Chair, I was thinking more of just in general, because I've thought about how to write it sometimes, and I'm never sure which word to use, which is the proper word. So, anybody else help me?
We're not going to touch that.
So. Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Hall and Mr. Chair, I'd welcome any opportunity if you'd like to discuss that further.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I have two questions under hot issues. You know, people are always trying to say, well, if this, then this, and under hot issues, pay equity. And I know this one well since I'm the Senate author, and what it says here is not at all what the way the law works. So as people are commenting on this, it just drives me insane that I don't think anyone has a stinking clue of how the statute works on pay equity. So I wish they'd do their homework. But I'm wondering how you imagine the comparable worth to actually cause more problems in terms of discrimination of wages and sex-based as well, because I believe the law actually causes these discriminations in as much as the way comparable worth of the pay equity works today is you can only compare certain people against certain other people. And in union jobs, members, just so you understand, our cities can only compare against other people from other cities or other those same union jobs. And so there's a lot of people that are discriminated against in the pay equity system, and I'm going to say especially women. So when you're working as a secretary or executive secretary at, say, a city, you can only be compared with another city, not with what's out there in the public sphere, which people get paid a lot more money out in the public sphere for the same kind of job. So I'm wondering where you might come up with that kind of a statement on that particular issue. Then I'll ask about the next issue.
Commissioner?
Yes, Senator Jungbauer?
Yes.
And Senator Chair, you could specifically point out the specific language which you were referring to within your question.
Well, under pay equity, Commissioner, Mr. Chair.
On page 6?
On page 8, under hot issues, you're saying if pay equity reporting mandates are removed from local governments, the department might see more sex-based. So what I look at it is under hot issues, you're arguing that I might need more people because this might do this and that might do that. But in what you're saying there, I'm seeing that whoever made this flyer up didn't have a clue what the law actually asks for and how we might actually get a new benefit out of the change in the law as opposed to a negative.
Senator Jungbauer, Mr. Chair, I don't necessarily think that we're saying things which are differently within this. I think sometimes any time in which there is a removal or a change within the law, there are individuals who view that there should be something to dispute or there might be ambiguity. But I do think, and again, this goes back to my earlier comment about working with small businesses, one of the things which I'd like to have and push the agency or nudge the agency is to provide information as relates to what the law states and provides, kind of more technical assistance. If you take a look at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission website, you'll see that there are directives or informational bulletins by the commissioner providing explanation as relates to the law. So I think this bullet point here on the hot issues, to the extent that there is a change in the law, it's always nice to have clarification somewhere out there for people to go to. And if we're so busy doing other things, we don't have time to provide that type of clarification concerning it.
Senator Jungbauer.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I guess that kind of begs a question. Then if somebody has the time to write up something on a hot issue instead of spending time, it's hard for me to say you're arguing in favor of your full budget. In fact, I'd say if you didn't have time to research this issue or some of the other issues under hot issues, but yet you had time to put them in this paper, you'd actually be arguing that we could reduce your budget because you have time to look at other things that aren't even on the horizon that you don't even know how they might affect you and make blanket statements. And, you know, going down to the next one on page 8 in terms of state-level immigration enforcement, you know, that somebody could even think that, you know, okay, we're going to think that we might disparately enforce that as well. So it just bothers me because you have to have, in my opinion, too much time on your hands to dream up that this might happen, so you might be busier. And so I get frustrated when we're talking about budget talks and people have time to dream up something that might be an issue and might not be an issue. So I just am frustrated with that, sure. Commissioner and members, that somebody would even present that to our committee while they're arguing that they don't have enough money in their budget or they need everything they have.
Senator Jungbauer and Mr. Chair, I guess how I would respond to it is I've been practicing in the area of employment law for over 20 years, and I can tell you, while Congress thought that they were very clear as it relates to the Age Discrimination of Employment Act, I could line up books going across one side of this chamber to the other, clarifying what was viewed as a clear statement of the law by the Congress. So I can appreciate what you are saying, but I can just tell you anecdotally, as an attorney who's been practicing for 20 years in employment, if you change the law, which you obviously can, and you may be as clear as you possibly can be, there will be some litigation and there will be some disputes over it.
And that's a fair answer. Thank you.
Sir Lance.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. First of all, welcome and congratulations, Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator Lance.
A bunch of issues have been raised. I want to, for the record, add just a few thoughts on it. With regard to Senator Jungbauer's questions, I think the answer might even go beyond what the Commissioner has diplomatically stated. My memory is, and maybe Ms. Pontius has memory better than I on this particular topic, but I think that there were some lawsuits, some class action lawsuits on the theory of comparable worth and pay equity prior to the state adopting a law mandating it for government agencies. And it's not at all, wouldn't take much time or creativity to conceive of an aggrieved woman thinking that she should be paid appropriately for her position as a discriminatorily based reduced wage because she's a woman, or the classification has a reduced wage because it's dominated by women in that particular class. It wouldn't take much at all to come up with a lawsuit on that basis. And similarly with the national origin discrimination charges, if the state enforces the immigration laws and they go after Hispanics more than they go after Liberians, then it wouldn't take much creativity for a Liberian or for an Hispanic to claim that they're being disproportionately targeted based on their national origin for the immigration enforcement. So I suggest these are both very realistic possibilities, in addition to just changes in law generating lawsuits that need judicial clarification of ambiguities. With regard to the Senator Newman's concern or question about settlement and versus conciliation, the department isn't a party in any of these cases until they make a decision after a probable cause finding. If the matter is unsuccessful in conciliation, they want to initiate the lawsuit or the administrative process as a party to the action. Up to that point, they're merely conciliators. They're acting as an independent go-between, trying to get the parties themselves, the employee that's been aggrieved, where the department has found probable cause, and the employer, to try to settle the case. So it's, as the Commissioner said, it's not necessarily the department's right to turn down a settlement. They're involved, so they will seek to have policy changes or employee personnel manuals and employer policies adjusted to reflect that. But ultimately, it's the employee or former employee that has the ability to decide to settle or not to settle in those kind of cases until the department, if they decide to actually take the case on as a party, does so. I think Senator Hall's raised an interesting question, because I struggle with the same issue myself, and I'm glad you brought it up. For what it's worth, you invited other feedback, is that gender, sex is probably the more antiquated term used to denote gender-related discrimination, but it's also a very commonly used term, and probably the most accurate term when talking about discrimination based on the status of being a female or being a male is probably gender. But when you get into sex harassment, it's used even differently, and because that has a specific connotation of harassment based upon a sexual identity. And federal law isn't even as clear on this point, too, which also confuses things. So you're probably safe using either one. I did have a question, I'm sorry, for the
you
commissioner.
You did.
In all of that, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I noticed there's been a substantial decrease in department staff since fiscal year 2003. I wonder if you have the information as to how many of the decrease in complement consisted of investigators.
Commissioner.
Senator Lance and Mr. Chair, I don't have the specific number as it relates to the impact on the complement of investigators, but I can share with you that it has been a significant impact as it relates to investigators. The individual investigators doing contract compliance and what I would consider investigations concerning harassment, they have been cross-trained. So it may be even difficult for the department to say categorically. It has only been in the harassment investigation area or in the contract compliance. But as it relates to the total number of investigators, it has gone down. Whether it has gone down 50%, I'm not quite able to say definitively here, but I feel that that's probably the neighborhood if you're talking about 2003.
50%, did you say?
Yeah.
Commissioner, has your caseloads gone down proportionally with the number of investigators that have been laid off?
Senator Lemmer, the question was, has the number of cases that we've been handling gone down? The answer, it ebbs and flows from one year to the next. There may be a slight decrease as it relates to the number of charges which are filed, but if we're talking about a consequential difference between the number of cases this past year as opposed to 5 years ago, I would say no. The number has probably slightly ticked up over the time period, but, you know, 20 or 30 cases one way or the other.
Commissioner, earlier in your presentation you made mention of, I think I heard you correctly, a particular caseload number per investigator. Could you tell me that again?
The number within is 37 on average.
Per year or at any given time?
Oh, when we're talking about the number that I referred to in my remarks, Mr. Chair, that's at any given time. That's not 37 just for the year.
All right. All right. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to some of the comments from Senator Latz and for the benefit of the commissioner, the reason I was asking the questions that I was is because I was very recently involved in a case that involved those questions, and specifically invited to participate in a settlement conference. And in that settlement conference, we had an individual who was there on behalf of the department. We also had an attorney that the department had contacted from the Attorney General's office that was present. And we were submitted with a proposal to settle. Now, I do understand the department's role in terms of being a party or not a party. I mean, that's all clear to me. But the reason I asked the question, Commissioner, is because in that instance, it was a contested matter as to whether or not the discrimination actually ever occurred. And I will tell you candidly, I was in effect running a test when we were presented with a request to settle for monetary damages and do the educational things that were being demanded of the department and accepted in total that which the department was asking of my client, but refused to pay any monetary damages whatsoever. And I want you to understand that in the context of this discussion, we have the Attorney General representing the department telling my client, if you don't settle, you are going to be responsible for significant monetary damages, plus attorney's fees, plus costs, plus fines. And I will tell you, it is an intimidating situation for a private citizen, the employer, to be in. And then under those circumstances, we refused to pay any monetary damages and invited the claimant, simply proceed with your claim through the civil court process. And I will tell you, Commissioner, that the department absolutely refused to accept our settlement offer. So those are the reasons why I was asking those questions. And there isn't any recourse that I am aware of within the Human Rights Act for the employer to protect themselves under those very, very intimidating circumstances. And that was the reason why I was asking the questions, Mr. Commissioner.
Senator Newman, Mr. Chair, if I could respond. What you were describing was very similar to the very first case that I ever tried, and that is, I won't get into all of the facts, but I'd suffice it to say the last offer that I received from the other side was close to $500,000. And at that time, I was at a law firm which had over 300 attorneys. I went to go speak to one of the senior partners, and he said, you know, if you can settle this case for a quarter of $1 million, $250,000, that would be great. We went to the judge, and the judge was trying to cajole the parties to sort of meet in the middle somewhere. But the judge was not able to get us to that point, nor could I get my client to get to that point. And I give you that because that's really how disputes are resolved, short of an administrative agency trying to work as a go-between the two. If the Department of Human Rights did not exist, that individual would have a right to file a complaint in district court. The spot that you were in, having someone look at both sides of the respective facts of the dispute and give you their advice as it relates to what is reasonable, is no different than what a district court judge would do. They would look at the facts from both sides and they'd give you their opinion. And you would then have the right to either agree or to say, no, I'm not willing to settle at that point in time. What I can assure you, though, is that I am going to work with all of my investigators to make sure they do a thorough investigation of all the respective facts. I will ensure that the investigators listen thoughtfully to both sides and that they know what the law is and that they give unbiased advice as relates to the respective parties that are before them. There are going to be some times, and there are some times, in which we tell charging parties, we do not believe that you have a case at all, and that it doesn't warrant and that there's no probable cause. And the vast majority, actually, of charges which are before the Department of Human Rights, that's the result. It's an issue of no probable cause.
Yes. One quick follow-up. I appreciate your response. The distinction that I would draw, Commissioner, is that in the case of you going before a judge to try and resolve a case, that district court judge is clearly a neutral party. In the case of the department proceeding on behalf of a claimant, you are not a neutral party. You are there as an advocate for that individual. Now, perhaps if that settlement negotiation was being conducted by, say, the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is outside of the department, then I would agree with you. But under your scenario, I really believe that the department is there as an advocate on behalf of the claimant. And the point that I was trying to make is the refusal of the department to settle unless monetary damages were paid to the claimant. That's the point I was trying to make. So I appreciate your comments, Mr. Commissioner.
We have to keep going beyond this.
Senator Newman, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. And I'd like to follow up with you because it warrants more conversation.
All right.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also welcome.
Thank you, Senator.
Congratulations. I'm a rural legislator, and I'm taking a glance here at the FTEs that you have. It says that you have 35 or... I think your paper says 40. Most of those are located, in fact, all of them are located in St. Paul except one FTE located in the St. Cloud regional office. And that regional office is funded by the St. Cloud Regional Human Rights Joint Powers Board. And there's been a lot of talk about disproportionality on this case and that case. I'm wondering, rural versus metro, how I can relate to my constituents out in greater Minnesota that the outreach program is working, or can you give me some assurance that there's some outreach to rural Minnesota when I see all the FTEs here in St. Paul except for one, and the one that's outstate is actually paid for by the outstate? Two questions come to mind. Is does St. Paul, Minneapolis pay for any of your funding, do you know? And what kind of outreach can you assure me that all Minnesotans are going to get from the Office of Human Rights when I see such disproportionality in numbers?
Senator Ingebrigtsen and Mr. Chair, as to your first question, do we receive any specific funding from the City of St. Paul or the City of Minneapolis? My understanding is that we do not receive any specific funding from them. As it relates to the commitment to outreach, I think I could share this with you. In my conversations with the governor and the chief of staff before my appointment, they stressed the importance of having their commissioners not just simply stay within the city of St. Paul, and that they see all of the 87 counties in the state of Minnesota. And I made my commitment that I would get on the road and travel throughout the entire state. So that is a commitment of mine, and it's going to be an important one.
Thank you. And just to follow up, this is not a question of you and your capabilities. It's the department in general over the past is where I'm directing these questions to. I'm not sure. I don't think you have rural versus metro or seven county with complaints here. Is that my problem is, and I'm glad to hear you say that, my problem is that folks out in outstate Minnesota are going to say, well, you know, if I got to go all the way to St. Paul, I'm not going to file that complaint, or I'm not going to follow up with something because I don't have the means to get there, or this or that. What in what would be the process in let's say Alexandria or Baudette, Minnesota? Should somebody have a complaint, would they have to contact your office? And just can you just take me real quickly through that,
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Mr. Chair? Generally, most people call in to our respective office through our caller intake. There would be an exchange of information. There would probably be a questionnaire which would be sent out, or a short form in which the person can then sign and verify the information which is provided by or to the department. And the department at that point in time would craft a charge to ensure that they understand sort of what has been communicated to them. As it relates to challenges outside of the seven county metro, and looking at the data, that was something that struck me as well. How can we ensure that we're achieving compliance throughout the entire state of Minnesota if we don't have a systematic way of tracking the information? So hopefully we'll have the resources to be able to do so.
Commissioner, when you were talking of the 37 cases of caseload for an investigator at any given time, that raises a question about just positions that might be available in your department. The testimony before your presentation, the courts were saying that they had to hold open some judge vacancies for 4 months to save some money. Are you holding any positions open now due to attrition, let's say?
Senator Limmer, did I just say Mr. Chair? Or
you can say either one. It's fine.
Mr. Chair, as relates to that question, I won't say it was the first hour, but it was definitely the first day that both two managers came to me with filled out forms saying that they would like to fill positions which had been left open from the previous administration.
I see. And has that position been filled by under your watch now?
I have identified candidates, but I have not made a decision to hire. I'm waiting to see sort of what the budget numbers will
be
for my agency.
All right. One other question that I had, does a citizen have any other means to avail themselves of a potential human rights complaint anywhere other than the Human Rights Department in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, yes, they do. They can file, though, specifically to state court or district court. Depending on the specific factual allegations, they may be able to file a claim in federal court as well.
Now, the way I understand it, if they were going to file in a, let's say, district court, quite often they may want to employ an attorney. And is that the same way it works in the Department of Human Rights, that they hire their own attorney, or do you act as, does your department act as their attorney at no charge?
Mr. Chair, as we let you, there's two questions there. I'll take the second one first. The department never acts as anyone's attorney until the commissioner has made a determination that they are going to take on that respective case. So there may be a situation in which a charging party is raising a unique or novel particular area. The commissioner may believe that there is no attorney in private practice willing or able to take on that particular case, and it warrants sort of someone to take up the case on behalf of the individual. Those are the rare, very rare situations. Okay. And speaking with the Attorney General's office, they were only able to identify five cases in the last 4 years where the commissioner undertook a charge and took it on. Now, as it relates to, going into district court?
District. I used the example of district court, Commissioner.
Yeah, as it relates to a specific attorney being involved, no, that is not necessary for an individual to file a charge with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And I would say most often it is the case that the individual is not represented by an attorney. But there are charges at the agency where the charging party is represented by an attorney.
And, Commissioner, is there ever a fee that your department would recognize, perhaps on an ability to pay, that you would charge the complainant for a fee for your services?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is the department has never charged a fee as it relates for the filing of a charge in which someone has alleged discrimination. I did have someone review sort of what has been done by other similar agencies throughout the country. And I am not aware of any agency charging a fee for the services it provides as far as investigating a claim of discrimination.
I was just thinking that if someone had a potential complaint, why would they want to go hire an attorney and bring it to a district court when they could simply give it to your department, have it have a cursory investigation to determine if there's cause, and then let you handle it on the taxpayer's dime?
Well, there's a couple of, Mr. Chair, there's a couple of reasons that I'd like to share with you as it relates to employment cases. To the extent that I believe that I had a very strong case, I may decide to go ahead and proceed and file in district court or in federal court, and the reason rationale is that I am able to recover attorney's fees. So from the very beginning of drafting the respective complaint, I would be able to potentially use that as leverage against the other side. As it relates to a charge which is filed before the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, I may assist my client in filing that respective charge, but it would be unclear, or at least an argument could be made by the other side, that attorney's fees aren't warranted as it relates to the particular resolution of the dispute. So if within your question, your suggestion is that attorneys would always use the department as opposed to proceeding right into state or federal court, I'm not sure I would necessarily agree with that proposition.
In the same regard, Commissioner, do you ever have overlap with other court services like civil legal services? Do they get involved in the same issues that the Department of Human Rights gets involved in?
Now, Mr. Chair, as it relates to overlap potentially between legal aid society or other potential legal interest groups out there in the community, yes, there's probably some times in which there is overlap. And I would say that those, for the most part, are cutting-edge issues in which people aren't clear as it relates to maybe where the law is on certain issues.
Could you tell me as an example, what a cutting-edge issue might be?
I'm trying to think if I've had one since March 2nd, which is the first day that I took over. I can't think of one specifically right now, but just prior experience would tell me, for example, accommodation in the area of what might be appropriate for an individual with a disability. Those require a balancing of several factors to determine what's a reasonable accommodation. That's probably a very ripe area for overlap.
How about tenant law or job-related discrimination? Would that fall into that as well?
As a commissioner of the St. Paul Public Housing Authority, having attended conventions in the past from other public housing authorities talking about their experience, I would say tenant law is probably an area as well, too, in which there could be overlap. I would say as a commissioner from the St. Paul Public Housing Authority, we have been very fortunate not to have those issues, but I have heard of those issues at national events. As it relates to garden variety employment-related issues, probably not as much.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Senator Laz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just note that I think it's entirely appropriate for the department to be advocating for financial compensation for an aggrieved employee in the situation Senator Newman raised, because the department has already found probable cause in that situation. They've conducted an independent review. They've analyzed the facts and the statements from the witnesses, and they've concluded that discrimination did occur. And one of the consequences of that discrimination in the case that was, for example, mentioned in the materials here was that the person was fired unlawfully and lost substantial income as a result. So I think it's entirely appropriate for the department in that case to make an important component of resolving that case, that the wrongfully terminated individual receive some compensation for their financial losses. Otherwise, think about it, every employer that was subject to a probable cause finding would simply say, okay, fine, we'll adopt the policies you suggest, let us off the hook now, end of story. Well, we all know the employers speak, that the language they speak has much more to do with their bottom line than with what paper policies they have. If their finances are going to be impacted, they're more likely to take appropriate steps to try to stop these kind of activities from occurring. So I applaud the department for taking those steps. The other thing is, especially with smaller cases, frankly, if a client comes into my office and says they think their losses are only $5,000, I'm not going to take the case because I'll never make any money on it. You know, there's no way that I can put in $10,000 or $15,000 worth of time, end up recovering $5,000 from my client, and come out ahead. I couldn't make a living that way. And I think they'll just simply never have lawyers. So sometimes in those cases, the department exists simply to give them a forum and an opportunity to try to hold the employer accountable. And in the end, often the department, even after they find probable cause, they may decide they don't have the resources to pursue the case on their own in district court. They've made the probable cause finding, and they'll simply dismiss the charges after that. And then it is indeed left up to the individual to try to find a lawyer to pursue the case in district court if they want to have a meaningful chance of getting recovery.
Okay.
So that's for what it's worth.
Any other questions?
I want to
thank you, Commissioner.
Senator Latz, I appreciate your comments. I appreciate you providing that additional information. Thank you all.
All right, thank you. Having no other further business before the committee, this meeting's adjourned.